All right, y'all. Welcome to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. And that's why you're listening, right? So I don't even need to tell you that. You know that. This is time for me and talking, interviewing. All right, well, I guess I should be a showman about it and hold you in suspense. Tomorrow, special guest, somebody or other, will be talking about something very important. You're going to want to not miss it. How was that? Was that good salesmanship? All right. Now, I'll go ahead and tell you. John Mearsheimer's going to be on the show tomorrow. He wrote this great thing in Foreign Affairs. In Foreign Affairs. About how the crisis in Ukraine is America's fault. Oh, yeah. And you know what? I've talked with Stephen Walt a lot of times, but his C-3PO to his R2-D2 over there, I've never talked to. John J. Mearsheimer, co-author of The Israel Lobby and American Foreign Policy, the paper and the book. He will be on the show to talk about Ukraine. Great article. It's running as the spotlight today on antiwar.com, and we're going to talk about some more here in just a little while, in fact. But he'll be on the show tomorrow. Also, Philip Weiss will be here to talk about the latest goings on in the Gaza Strip, and I'm going to have to catch up during some commercial breaks here and something, because I am certainly behind on what's going on. I know that, oh yeah, somebody said somebody shot a rocket or whatever was the excuse. I don't know. Maybe it's true. Maybe not. I think, actually, wasn't the Israeli Air Force bombing them all along? And then, oh, but your rocket is, that came after that, is the cause of our retaliation. You know how it goes. I swear I had a Mondo Weiss tab open here somewhere. Oh, there it is. I knew I had it here somewhere. And then, yeah, also tomorrow we're going to be talking with John Whitehead from the Rutherford Institute. And he's written another great article about the American police state. And you know what? I don't know that much about him, but he seems to come from a pretty conservative, now becoming more libertarian type point of view. And that's good, because he's just mad for the Bill of Rights and against the American police state. And he really knows what the hell he's talking about. He really does good work. And hang on one second. And the thing of it is that it's important to have the police state attacked from the right and not the too far radical patriot right where it can just be written off as unimportant or whatever, but from more or less sort of kind of National Review-y mainstream conservatism saying, whoa, hey, this is just out of control here. We got to stop it. Because it's so easy for law and order conservatives to just write off hippie opposition to whatever as simply hippie opposition. When you have somebody like John Whitehead going, I worship George Washington, and here's what he would have me do. Stop this police state. Then, yeah, you know, that can be, it's important. It's important for building consensus to try to preserve what little liberty we got left. Anyway, John Whitehead, he's good on this stuff, so that'll be on tomorrow. And I forgot to mention, I'm sorry, man. When I was saying Israel, I said Phil Weiss is going to be on the show to talk about what's going on in Gaza. But that's not all. Phil Giraldi is going to be here to talk about the Israeli government's propaganda campaign, their Hasbara, and exactly how it works and who's behind it and how many people work for them and how much you pay for it. Yes, perception management. Giraldi is going to be on to talk about that. And then also he wrote an article, that's at the American Conservative, he wrote another one for uns.com. And over there it's about fascism. And it's about how, I'm not sure who he's referring to, I didn't do the click through, I forget if there's even a link. But he refers to a friend of his, is a former JAG lawyer for the United States, I think, Air Force. And how she wrote a thing about the rule of law and we should stop killing people and torturing people and this kind of thing. For, I think, the Miami Herald. And then Phil's article is just riffing off of the comment section. You know, it could be called Things Right-Wingers Believe, or better, Slogans Right-Wingers Have Memorized. And, hey, that kind of thing can be dangerous. People deliberately turning off their brain in favor of belief in some glorious past that can only regain with violence. Yeah, that's pretty bad. That's what it used to be called, conservatism in America, but I think, you know, the mask is kind of coming off. Wouldn't you say? Anyway, there's Phil Giraldi. Lifelong Republican type, former CIA officer, patriotic flag-waving Catholic. And he's saying, whoa, look out, because you're spiraling towards a totalitarian police state here. Out of control, lawless police state. And with a good enough proportion of Americans loving it to really kind of entrench it, to make it at least more than a little bit of a threat. And as scary and crazy as it is to say it, we're sort of lucky it's the Democrats in power right now. Because when those populist state-worshipping right-wingers have a Republican to rally behind in the White House as their chief alpha male, you know, leader of setting stuff on fire and what have you, well, they go mad like apes. You remember 2002, 2003. You're a traitor. You love Saddam. You love terror. You love terrorists. Your Romans 13 says, shut up, boy. That's conservatism with a Republican president. It can be really problematic, and it could be worse, you know? Bush was actually kind of a softy compared to what they were demanding of him, come to think of it. You know what I mean? He could have called out the National Guard at the airports, but instead he called the governors and asked them to go ahead and call out the guard, which isn't that much better, but it's a little bit better, you know? He could have just called them all out to every street corner and left them there for a few years anyway. They'd have been happy with that. Orange alert. Duck and cover. Anyway, carrying a cross and wrapped in a flag and all that American-style police state stuff. We're going to be talking about that with Phil Giraldi on the show, too. And now, I guess, real quickly, because I don't have all that much to say about it, I don't suppose, but I guess I ought to mention, in case you hadn't heard, you ought to know the news, and I think it's kind of sad. I'm not exactly a journalist, but I like journalists. Some of them. I mean, I hate a lot of journalists, too. But some of them I really like and respect, and it's a very scary job. And in fact, you know, I consider a lot. Maybe I could go be a war reporter or something, but I don't want to get killed. I'd rather stay here safe in Texas and try to talk about why to not have these wars than actually go over there and put my life at that much risk. I plan on dying of old age if I can. But some of these guys, man, they go over there, they risk their lives over and over again to report on what the hell is going on over there. And this guy, James Foley, I didn't know him or even know about him. But yesterday, the Islamic State put a video on YouTube of them cutting his head off. Which is, you know, aside from being an absolutely horrible way for him to have to die, also to be murdered, to be killed. You'd be amazed how many headlines played that down yesterday. You know, everybody who ever actually knew him and cared about him, they got to deal with that. That's pretty severe, man. Imagine how traumatic that is for them. So, pretty horrible. And you know, rest in peace and all that stuff. It's horrible. They think that maybe it was a Guantanamo inmate that did it. He had a British accent, and he had his captive dressed in an orange jumpsuit. Perhaps meaningful. Damn break. I'll be back in a second. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. Darrenscoffee.com. Me. All right, welcome back. Ah, geez. Time zone difficulties with Mearsheimer. Well, I'm going to work it out. Let's see what's going to happen. All right, I'm Scott. And yeah, the break happened, so I didn't have enough time to say what I want to say. Just a little bit about James Foley, this American journalist. I think they said he's from New Hampshire, who was murdered by the Islamic State. And you know what? I don't know. What were the chances he was ever coming home safe and sound? I don't know. You know, the Al-Nusra Front, they at one time kidnapped our friend David Enders and then let him go and let him live. So, you know, I don't know. But it's certainly the case that in his statement, he said this is the consequence of Barack Obama starting the American bombing campaign. In the statement he was forced to read, he said, America signed my death warrant. That's certainly what they want us to understand. Just the very beginning of the blowback from this latest intervention there. You know, it's funny because really the blowback is in the rise of the Islamic State. Remember, the definition of blowback isn't just that it's consequences. It's consequences from covert foreign policy, secret foreign policies, covert action, clandestine, this, that. I forgot what all those definitions differences are, but anyway. Secret foreign policies, consequences from secret foreign policies. Then government can say to us, oh my God, look everybody, bunch of planes come hit us out of the clear blue sky, you saw them, and don't have to explain. In this case, oh my God, Nouri al-Maliki didn't do a good enough job of hugging those Sunnis, and so all of a sudden there's an Islamic State. But it's a supposed secret, even though it was all over the New York Times and the Washington Post for the last, you know, and every other paper on earth, every British paper, every German paper, every Middle East paper for the last 3 years, America has been doing everything they can to marginalize the secular Baathist fascist dictatorship in Egypt and support the rise of the rebel movements against them. And people go, oh no, they just want to back the moderates. Well, the Saudis and the Qataris have been backing the extremists all along, the Turks too. So what does that tell you? You know, for years on this show, I said to Giraldi, I said to Ray McGovern, I said to Flint Leverett, every former CIA guy I know, I would say to them, hey man, if Saudi and Qatar and Turkey are supporting the real bad guy, extremist, suicide bomber, prisoner, beheader, crucifier, madmen, bin Ladenites, Zarqawiites there, and America isn't telling them to stop it, then isn't that really not plausible deniability, but just attempted plausible deniability? Like when Ronald Reagan sold missiles to the Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran, and he had the Israelis do it. They were the cutout. The Israelis get dropped from the story, not just because of the power of the Israel lobby, but because it's kind of a footnote. It doesn't matter. It was Ronald Reagan was selling missiles to the Ayatollah. The fact that he paid the Israelis to give some of the missiles we'd already given to them to the Ayatollah, and then we would pay them back what we already gave them in the first place, that didn't matter. That was just not plausible deniability. That was just part of the structure for the cover story. It was America was doing it. Same thing here. It's not like Obama ever tried to tell the Saudis, the Qataris, the Turks, stop it. In fact, he had the CIA help coordinate all along. And yes, it's true. They've set up the argument beautifully. that, well, Hillary Clinton wanted him to back the rebels, and that if we had only created a third force of moderate rebels, and they would have beaten Assad and ISIS. What? Now, they never have to explain that, because they're just lying. It doesn't make any sense, because it's not true, but it makes for a good little talking point if they just kind of, oh, yeah, you know, we wanted to back the moderates more, and then, but Obama wouldn't do it, and then you're just supposed to kind of fill in the gaps of how it was supposed to work somehow. With some, you know, sketchy cartoon drawing in your imagination. But the president actually is right when he says that that's a complete fantasy. And in fact, he said that was horse shit. See how I pronounced that safely? Regulators? Shht. I tried to say it. Shht. Yeah, it's absolutely crazy. And he did support the rebels enough to weaken Assad. And he diplomatically did everything he could to marginalize Assad and tell the rebels, you don't have to cooperate with him. You don't have to deal with him. When the moderate government councils of sock puppets and expats that they set up said, okay, we want to deal with Assad now, they said, no, don't. Or at least when they could have said, you have to deal with Assad, they said, no, don't. He has to leave power before anyone will talk with his government, which is just a deal he can't possibly accept. And as the Israelis said repeatedly, and their partisans too, let them keep fighting. We prefer that they just keep fighting and degrading each other, both sides. The Baath, Shiite, minority coalition, fascist government, and the suicide bomber jihadists too. And let them keep fighting and fighting and weaken each other. Again, I'll probably say this on every show as long as I'm on the radio. Michael Oren, the Israeli ambassador to the United States, explained to the Jerusalem Post last October 2013, this is what we want to do. We hate Hezbollah and Syria and Iran more than we hate Al-Qaeda, he said. And so we prefer that Al-Qaeda continue, if not win outright, at least continue to bog down Hezbollah and Assad and whatever. And of course, all they're doing is giving Hezbollah battlefield experience, right? And the whole thing is bound to blow up in their face in every way anyway. The Turks were wrong. Everybody was wrong. They were going to be able to get rid of Assad easy. And so instead, we got blowback big time. The American people have been told all along, oh, if only Obama would back the rebels. In fact, he was backing them. And everything he was given to the so-called moderates, even according to the New York Times, admissions of guilt on the part of the state. Everything they're given to the moderates is ending up in the hands of the al-Nusra Front at best. They say, no, we're arming the Islamic Front. The Islamic Front is just the procurement arm of the al-Nusra Front, the guys who are al-Qaeda, who's sworn loyalty to Ayman al-Zawahiri. And to ISIS, who have broken off from Al-Qaeda, not because, they're too brutal, but because they wouldn't obey instructions from Zawahiri, who was stupid to give them instructions that they didn't want to obey when he had no means of enforcing it. But he's a stupid idiot, so he's marginalized himself really badly from the current situation. But anyway, that's the only split between Nusra and ISIS and really any of the rest of the smaller groups that work with them in the war over there. They're all a bunch of bin Ladenites. The Sunnis, who aren't a bunch of bin Ladenites, are still part of the Baathist coalition. It's not a purely everybody versus the Sunnis kind of thing there. A lot of the Sunnis are still with the Baathist coalition. It's basically just the jihadists are fighting. And it's hilarious. All these conspiracy theories are still going on today with the murder here. They're saying, well, we assumed that Assad had abducted the guy. Or we thought Assad had abducted the guy, so Assad must have given him over to ISIS to behead. Another point, based on an assumption, another point for their conspiracy theory that it's Assad who created ISIS. Based on the fact that ISIS has been basically too smart to confront his military head on and be destroyed. So, oh yeah, they're working together all along. Yeah, no, there's four fingers pointing back at you. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
How can you shoot women, children?
Easy. You just don't need them so much. Ain't war hell?
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria? Hamas is now supporting the opposition. Are we supporting Hamas in Syria? So I think, Wyatt, you know, despite the great pleas that we hear from those people who are being ruthlessly assaulted by Assad, if you're a military planner or if you're a secretary of state and you're trying to figure out, do you have the elements of an opposition that is actually viable? We don't see that.
Well, by identifying those people who are on our side, we can identify who these people are. We can help the right people.
There, see, yeah. And he's the guy who went and met with the Northern Storm Brigade, who had already told Time Magazine, and it was on video on the internet, that, yeah, we're all veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, where we fought with Zarqawi against the Americans. And then he wanted to have a slumber party, and that wasn't an accusation. That was his sock puppets told that to the Daily Caller. Yeah, John McCain wanted to have a sleepover, but his security insisted that we had to go. Yeah, that's some really good rebel vetting you're doing there, bud. Well, the Al-Farouk Brigade, they wanted to hold elections. They're pretty moderate, except that it was their leader that was on video eating a guy's heart, a dead Syrian soldier's heart. But other than that, you know, the cannibalism, they're also pretty moderate, too. So you could see how there's a lot of moderate rebels there that the Democrats are trying to back. All right, anyway. Hey, let's talk about Somalia. It's our friend Thomas Mountain. You can find him a lot of times at Counterpunch. And he's got one here about the real dirty war in the Horn of Africa. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Great to be back. It's been a long time.
Yeah. Good to talk to you again. Good to have you writing about Somalia. It's a very important topic because, as I like to try to point out on the show all the time, it's all America's fault. It's all the empire's fault. It's unbelievable the consequences for the people of this, I don't mean to be mean, but just pathetic little land where they just never have gotten a leg up in their whole damn history, dominated by somebody or another, never really had a chance. And then here comes the most powerful power in the history of the solar system, just been beating the hell out of for now more than 8 years running. And I mean, you know, directly. So it's just, it's such a hell of a story. I don't know. I don't want to ask you to go too far back because we've talked about all that. Go ahead and start with your criticism of Scahill if you'd like, because it's important.
Well, I'm glad you think that. I was a bit harsh, but basically what happened was there was the worst drought and famine in the Horn of Africa in 60 years, beginning of 2011, running till the end of 2012, about 2 years. Now, in Somalia proper, the UN has publicly announced that at least 250,000 people died from starvation in that time period. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that they're not talking about is next door to Somalia, where the Somali people of the Ogaden, which is still part of Ethiopia, live, and they comprise a population of almost as much as the Somali people, maybe 75% of Somalia. There was a drought and famine there as well. The only difference was in Somalia, there was some food aid being distributed, even though the UN budgeted only 10 cents a day to feed the Somalis that were affected by the drought. And in the Ogaden, actually there was a food and medical aid blockade where the Ethiopian regime, which is a client state of the United States, whose former prime minister was eulogized at his funeral by the present National Security Advisor to Barack Obama, Susan Rice. She got up and praised this guy who put in a food and medical aid blockade in the worst drought and famine in 60 years. He'd expelled the Red Cross and Doctors Without Borders. Now, what country in the world expels both Red Cross and Doctors Without Borders during the worst drought and famine in 60 years, and yet their prime minister gets eulogized at his funeral by a senior U.S. official? Mm-hmm. Now, you know, the thing is, the crimes that are being, the dirty wars that are being committed in the Horn of Africa aren't just restricted to Somalia. Ethiopia is, you know, they invaded Somalia back in 2006, and did some serious damage to the country, destabilized the new government that had brought peace to Somalia, evicted the new government that brought peace to Somalia for the first time in 20 years, the Union of 15 years, the Union of Islamic Courts. Ethiopia is also involved in South Sudan. The Ethiopian regime is supporting this rebel leader named Riek Machar. It's going out and carrying out all this murder and mayhem in South Sudan, trying to do a coup against the government. All the reports are coming out talking about tens of millions of dollars of weapons pouring into South Sudan, but nobody's telling you where they're really coming from. And the fact is, for a year now, well, 8 months now, the Riek Machar-led rebellion has been going along, you know, continuing the fight, and nobody's explaining where they're getting the support from, where they're getting their funds from, where they're getting their weapons from. And so, you know, this is coming from the Ethiopians. And who's behind all this? It's the Americans are behind this because the United States wants to see China out of the African oil business. The Sudanese oil fields are the only Chinese majority-owned oil infrastructure in Africa. And the United States gets about half of its imported oil from Africa, and it's in the U.S. national interest to see China shut out of the African oil supply. And Sudan is the only Chinese-controlled oil field. And again, the Chinese oil fields are shut down because of this war. So the only winner from all this brutality and mayhem and murder in South Sudan is the United States because they've got China out.
Right.
Now, that should point people somewhere because the United States government is an organized crime outfit. They're a crime syndicate that's at the forefront of these major crimes. I mean, the guy that headed up the UN when a 250,000 Somalis were starving to death, he was the head of UNICEF, is Anthony Lake, former National Security Advisor to Bill Clinton and failed nominee to head the CIA. And he's the guy that oversaw this famine, made sure that only 10 cents a day got to the Somalis when they were starving. And 250,000 starved to death at least, and that's just in Somalia. Maybe another 200,000 died in the Ogaden. Okay, now...
No, wait a minute. Hang on one second, Thomas, because I want to interrupt you just to clarify one fact here, that when you say 250,000 people died, that's according also to the UN, or basically a sort of pseudo-NGO break-off of the UN that is funded by the US and the UK, the guiltiest parties here. It's their FEWSNET, F-E-W-S-N-E-T, is the Famine Anticipation Research Institute, whatever the hell. They're the ones who say 260,000. They're the ones who say most of them were children under 5 years old. So, sorry, I just want to make sure we had your footnote there.
Yeah, good. Yeah, no, that's a very important point you're making there. Now,
I mean, a quarter of a million people just basically laying down and starving to death.
Yeah, we're talking about average in a two-year period, 250,000. That's 10,000 people a month were dying of starvation. That's 300 people a day were dying in the Horn of Africa, and that's just in Somalia. That doesn't include the ones that were starving to death in Ethiopia under this enforced food and medical aid blockade.
All right, now, wait a minute. We're going to have a whole other segment, but... But let me, before you go on, let me try to follow up another couple of things here real quick. Now, when the famine hit, Somalia was hit especially hard because it had been a war zone the whole time. And so even if anybody could grow anything, all the markets were just completely disrupted and no one was able to distribute food, that kind of thing. But in the Ogaden region in Ethiopia, was that also a war zone? I mean, you said that they were deprived of the emergency food aid that the Somalis got, although, like you said, also Tony Lake hardly gave them anything. You know, here's the silver dime, have fun, kids, kind of thing. But so why was it so bad in Ethiopia? Is that because of civil war inside Ethiopia?
There's a counterinsurgency against the independence movement in the Ogaden. The Ogaden people are Somalis. They don't consider themselves part of the Somalia. They consider Ogaden to be a separate nation, and they've been fighting for quite some time now for independence from the Ethiopian regime. And it just so happens that the Ogaden holds much of the natural gas reserves that Ethiopia has planned.
All right, sorry. Thomas, we got to stop. We got to stop right there and take this break. We'll be right back, everybody, with Thomas Mountain, counterpunch.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. All right, y'all. So no, I admit I don't know nearly enough about Ethiopia's war against the Amoros is what they call themselves, right? The Somalis, they're sort of Somalis, sort of Ethiopian, something like that. Thomas, please, I'm sorry we were interrupted by the break there. Go on. Are you there? Oh, I lost him. God dang it, Bobby. Oh man, well let me see here. It's gonna. Wait, babies, that's not a very long clip. Oh, here we go.
Now that the war is over and there's some difficulty with the peace, was it worth doing?
Well, I think it was unquestionably worth doing, Charlie. And I think that looking back, I now certainly feel I understand more what the war was about. We needed to go over there, basically, and take out a very big stick. Right in the heart of that world and burst that bubble. And there was only one way to do it. And what they needed to see was American boys and girls going house to house from Basra to Baghdad and basically saying, which part of this sentence don't you understand? You don't think, you know, we care about our open society? You think this bubble fantasy, we're just going to let it grow? Well, suck on this. Okay, that, Charlie, was what this war was about. We could have hit Saudi Arabia. It was part of that bubble. Could have hit Pakistan. We hit Iraq because we could. That's
while
the
I was there, I saw the Iraqi soldiers come into the hospital with guns. They took the babies out of the incubators. Took the incubators and left the children to die on the cold floor.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice, but we think the price is worth it.
In Kyiv itself, some of the barricades around the Maidan have come down.
I think Yats is the guy who's got the economic experience, the governing experience. He's the guy, you know, what he needs is Cleach and Tony Book on the outside. He needs to be talking to them four times a week, you know. I just think Cleach going in, he's going to be at that level working for Yatsenyuk. It's just not going to work.
All right, y'all. That's stupid. Victoria Nuland there. All right. Well, anyway, so I don't know what happened to Thomas Mountain. His phone went out. Right as we were coming back on the air there, I think. And I was hoping he was going to continue there about the Amoros. I'd try calling him back 10 times. I don't know, man. I don't want to give up, though. Hey, listen. Here's the editor of Foreign Affairs, Gideon Rose, on the Colbert Report on February the 24th, 3 days after the coup d'etat in Kyiv.
Uh-huh. It's basically Robin to Russia's Batman. And the challenge here is to try to attract it to the West, to get it to flip sides.
Is America taking sides in this in any way? If these people, the rebels are winning right now, right?
Yes, just recently.
Why isn't Obama spiking the ball in the end zone and calling Putin and saying, hey, you might have won the medal count, but we won the country count, biatch.
It's actually a very good question, and the answer is that we don't want Russia to intervene and kick over the table like a game of Risk and take Ukraine back. And so
would they do that? Could he send in troops?
Yes, he could. So we are choosing...
Now, does Ukraine have any troops of their own? Would they fight back?
Yes, but we don't want this to escalate, and we don't want Russia to crack down. So we want to basically distract Russia. Oh, look, you have the highest medal count. Oh, you did really well. And
is that,
you know,
possible?
Focus on the Olympics.
Here's a shiny object. We'll just take an entire country away from you.
Basically.
Now, So there's a power vacuum right now.
There's a power vacuum. The opposition is all together, which everybody, it's easy to agree on getting rid of the bad old regime and much harder to create a stable country in which everybody compromises and moves forward. The reason we don't want Putin to get involved in this. And so we want to try and involve him in this decision so that he allows Ukraine to go. We actually want to non-exclusive.
You know what? Here's Obama.
You can have a relationship with
him. You know what? I don't care what he has to say. No, he might declare more war. I better listen.
Jim Foley by the terrorist group ISIL.
We'll get back to the Ukraine thing in a minute, guys.
A son, a brother, and a friend. He reported from difficult and dangerous places, bearing witness to the lives of people a world away. He was taken hostage nearly 2 years ago in Syria, and he was courageously reporting at the time on the conflict there. Jim was taken from us in an act of violence that shocks the conscience of the entire world. He was 40 years old, one of five siblings. The son of a mom and dad who worked tirelessly for his release. Earlier today, I spoke to the Foleys and told them that we are all heartbroken at their loss and joined them in honoring Jim and all that he did. Now, Jim Foley's life stands in stark contrast to his killers. Let's be clear about ISIL. They have rampaged across cities and villages, killing innocent, unarmed civilians in cowardly acts of violence. They abduct women and children and subject them to torture and rape and slavery. They have murdered Muslims, both Sunni and Shia, by the thousands. They target Christians and religious minorities, driving them from their homes, murdering them when they can. For no other reason than they practice a different religion. They declare their ambition to commit genocide against an ancient people. So ISIL speaks for no religion. Their victims are overwhelmingly Muslim, and no faith teaches people to massacre innocents. No just God would stand for what they did yesterday and what they do every single day. ISIL has no ideology of any value to human beings. Their ideology is bankrupt. They may claim out of expediency that they are at war with the United States or the West, but the fact is they terrorize their neighbors and offer them nothing but an endless slavery to their empty vision and the collapse of any definition of civilized behavior. And people like this ultimately fail. They fail because the future is won by those who build and not destroy. And the world is shaped by people like Jim Foley and the overwhelming majority of humanity who are appalled by those who killed him. The United States of America will continue to do what we must do to protect our people. We will be vigilant and we will be relentless. When people harm Americans anywhere, we do what's necessary to see that justice is done, and we act against ISIL, standing alongside others. The people of Iraq, who with our support are taking the fight to ISIL, must continue coming together to expel these terrorists from their communities. The people of Syria, whose story Jim Foley told, do not deserve to live under the shadow of a tyrant or terrorists. They have our support in their pursuit of a future rooted in dignity. From governments and peoples across the Middle East, there has to be a common effort to extract this cancer so that it does not spread. There has to be a clear rejection of these kind of nihilistic ideologies. One thing we can all agree on is that a group like ISIL has no place in the 21st century. Friends and allies around the world, we share a common security and a common set of values that are rooted in the opposite of what we saw yesterday. And we will continue to confront this hateful terrorism and replace it with a sense of hope and civility. That's what Jim Foley stood for. A man who lived his work
All right. Who courageously told the story. I don't know if we're hearing more newsworthy out of him, really, other than, you know, pretending to care about this one report or whatever. So, I mean, you heard what he just said. He's just declaring more war. That's all. You see how bad these ISIS guys are? They're bad. Nobody can argue with that. But that's a writ for war. I could argue with that. But they just skip that part. They go, look, these guys are absolute barbarians, so we're going to kill them. And for Americans with no historical memory of even their most recent history, that'll be good enough. The American Superman is going to go save the day in Iraq again, like that time we liberated France from the Nazis or whatever. It's a good enough myth. It works time and again. And so here we go again. Hey, y'all, Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. All right, guys, welcome back. I'm sorry. You know what? Back when George Bush was president, when he talked, I just get so freaking mad. Oh, I get so angry at him. When Obama comes on TV and talks, I just space out. I just can't listen to him. I can't stand him so bad that it's like a child blocking out their ritual abuse when they were a kid or something. I just can't hear it. It's like a Gungan in my Star Wars movie. I just watch around it. I'm unable to experience it. It doesn't. So I had to read the tweet from USA Today, had the quote. I'm sitting here right in front of you guys, ostensibly watching and listening to the same damn clip of the Emperor as you. I didn't even hear him say, we will be vigilant and we will be relentless. We will be relentless. Oh my God. And then all Twitter blows up. Oh, Barack Obama, we love you. Finally, he's talking like a real leader. Oh, my God. Just because they cut one guy's head off. Let me tell you about ISIS, man. They've been cutting people's heads off. America's been backing them since they've been cutting people's heads off, crucifying their enemies in the town square. At least pseudo, kind of, sort of, indirectly, but mostly pretty freaking much directly backing him. Plausible deniability included, but still, yeah, America backing him. And yeah, they are Al-Qaeda in Iraq. That's who they are. It's Zarqawi's group. They were sort of tamped down for a minute. Then Syria... 2011 through now gave him a chance to come back. The West helped. Saudi helped. And now it's blowing back. And, man, yeah, so here's Al-Qaeda in Iraq, all right. There's this myth going around, and you can see people just repeating each other. Like Mina Bird saying, oh, you know what happened was, even our sort of friend Barbara Slavin, who we interview sometimes about Iran, I saw her writing this, but it's not plagiarized, it's just, oh, it's that consensus. Oh, you know, the rise of ISIS is all Assad's fault. See, because he opened the jail, not because that was a demand that he would compromise with all the protesters and let some of their people out of jail at the time. No, never mind the context of what was going on there. No, he only opened the jails up in order to let out jihadists so that they would fight against him because that would discredit the rest of the rebellion. Well, even if that's a tiny bit true, like for his own public relations purposes, that he would rather have more bad guys out on the loose to try to discredit his enemies, you know, that makes sense. It's just politics, right? That's not too bad of a conspiracy theory that he might calculate that that's a good idea. But so what? That doesn't mean anything. Unless the premise is that, oh yeah, no, all of Al-Qaeda in Iraq or virtually all of Al-Qaeda in Iraq were locked in Assad's jails before 2011. Well, but that's just not true. They basically, when the Sunni Awakening broke out, they joined it, a lot of them. And the rest mostly went home. Yes, some got killed. But, you know, as soon as the rebellion broke out, as soon as even the protest movement broke out in Syria in 2011, there were Syrian veterans of the Iraq War who immediately organized to go to war. In fact, I interviewed that lady, wrote this great thing, The Jihad Next Door, for a Politico magazine. You wouldn't think that they have a magazine, but it's actually really good. The Jihad Next Door. And she's, you know, doesn't emphasize any kind of American support or allied support for anybody in that article. But it's fine because, you know, other than not really asking those questions in there, she certainly goes down the road of who started doing what when. And Jabhat al-Nusra and Syria and al-Qaeda started forming and going to war immediately in 2011. And the fact that Assad never really directly, not never really, but never emphasized attacks on ISIS, but preferred to fight al-Nusra, it was only logical. It was al-Nusra that was attacking him. It wasn't a bunch of moderates. It was al-Qaeda that was attacking him. And the reason that he ignored ISIS is because they were leaving him alone. That doesn't mean that they had a conspiracy, that he was behind them. It was Saudi was behind him, if anybody was behind him. Saudi and the American Empire were behind him. If the closest you could get to reality along the lines of this popular conspiracy theory is that they had a tacit understanding that, hey, we don't seem to be attacking each other, which makes sense, so go ahead. Assad isn't ready to retake the East. He can't anyway. So, all right, even by their argument, having ISIS as the leaders of the rebels in the East makes him seem like the more plausible alternative to all outside foreign powers and populations and everybody else, right? But at the same time, ISIS would be crazy to fling themselves headlong at Damascus or at the actual Syrian army. You know, they put some heads on pikes, but that was a base way out in the middle of nowhere, isolated, that they had had under siege for months and months, which they finally stormed and killed the last holdouts in there. But in, you know, Damascus-held territory, the territory is held. They'd just be killing themselves and accomplishing nothing tactically or strategically by taking on the Syrian army headlong. Let Nusra kill themselves, the Islamic State guys have apparently figured. The same reason why they have not flung themselves headlong at Erbil or at Baghdad either. Because those guys have the forces to defend themselves. Instead, they've taken over lawless Sunnistan in northwestern Iraq and Anbar province, the Sunni triangle, and eastern Syria, where no one else rules and they can fill up the vacuum, and the local population might resist them, but not for major sectarian reasons. The local population are virtually all Sunni Arabs, other than the small minority groups that they're persecuting the hell out of. But they're not outside of their lines, the Islamic State. They're basically just filling in that the Sunni stand lines. So the idea that, you know, you might as well say that Nouri al-Maliki's been behind ISIS all along just because he kept pissing off the Sunni tribes and giving them reason to ally with these guys. Well, that's not the same thing. And the fact that Maliki has not really, let's see, ISIS captured Fallujah last December and Maliki bombed the hell out of it. But he didn't really accomplish anything. He sure didn't attack and try to dislodge them from Fallujah. Does that mean that Maliki was in conspiracy with ISIS too? It's just a talking point because people are so used to the approved centrist consensus position for the last 3 years, despite any logic or reason or detail whatsoever, that because Israel prefers it this way, Assad is the bad guy in Syria. The worst guy in Syria, not the jihadist suicide bombers, the most bin Ladenite of the Sunni, what we call the Sunni-based insurgency in Iraq. The bad guys from the war America fought, you know, those who dared to resist us, and the worst of their friends. The Zarqawiites, the guys that bomb schools and marketplaces full of women and children, the guys who crucify their enemies to death. Yeah, they're barbarians, all right, huh? I guess Assad is behind them and not America. Huh? It has been America and America's allies that have been supporting this whole thing this whole time. And it's a crime the way that they get away with it and spin it that their enemy, the Assad government, which again, that they're not directly attacking for now, but still, they're someone who they have no common ground with whatsoever. Putting him behind them, it just obfuscates the whole damn issue, you know? It's completely ridiculous. You know, part of it probably is, well, you know, we don't want to just outright take sides in Sunni Shia civil wars. This is just, we have to pick and choose our policies based on what's the right thing at the right time. And a lot of it is just a muddle. And the right thing at the right time most often is, well, what would Benjamin Netanyahu have us do? He hates Assad, so I guess we do. Even if Assad's enemies are a bunch of little Osamas. And then Barack Obama comes on and says, oh, he's horrified by the death of one white guy over there. And so now, never mind the Yazidis on the mountain. That was a bunch of crap. But here's something that really happened. Let's go to war based on this, guys. Come on. And everybody's so upset, they just say, okay. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
Yay.
Hey, man, David Enders is back in Iraq. I'm going to see if I can get him on the show this week. Oh, crap. I was supposed to email Jim Bamford this morning, and I completely forgot. I even have him here in my notes. Bamford. Tomorrow. I'm sorry. I will do my best to get him on. He couldn't do it last week because he was traveling, but I want to talk to him about that Snowden thing he did for Wired there. You know, these hard breaks, man, they screw me up. Let me tell you a thing. I saw a friend on Twitter yesterday ask, do these guys, with this beheading of this journalist, do they think they're going to do anything other than draw us in? Come on. Wise up, man. That's the whole game here. That's the whole thing. The action is in the reaction. Just because these people can't speak a language that you understand doesn't mean that they're stupid cavemen. In fact, just because they're savage murderers doesn't mean that they're stupid cavemen. Okay? They're not just cutting off the guy's head as punishment, as this is what happens when you mess with us, blah, blah, blah. I mean, I guess you could say in the way, say that in a way, I guess the idea is that, you know, if they could scare us into just stop poking the hornet's nest and get the hell out of there, then that would work. But they don't expect that. They know better than that. And so that would be sort of the side thing. If that worked out, fine. The main point is to draw us in further. You know, this guy Baghdadi and his buddies, they walk around with suicide belts on. The top leadership of this group. And, you know, they're in it for the long haul. They are collectivists, even if we are not. And so in their mind, it makes perfect sense. And I don't read Arabic. I don't know everything all these guys are saying to each other all the time. But it makes perfect sense that they would consider, hey, if we cut this guy's head off, what might happen? Maybe we'll draw them further in. Maybe that's what we want. They might have even asked the question, how might we draw them further in? How about we cut this journalist's head off? Yeah, that's likely to do the trick. You know, the Kurdish public relations firms got their whole Yazidi propaganda ratcheted up a few weeks back. That was pretty good, but here's a real American. And not the only one. In their hands. So they murder him on YouTube. And the point is, I assume The point is that if they could recreate the entire last Iraq war occupation of Sunnistan and fight against the Americans, they would do that. It just helped to further, even over the long term, even if they die in it and don't see the end. It'll just rally more people to their cause. It'll just destabilize the whole region more. It'll just bankrupt and demoralize the American people and the American empire more. And in their mind, probably bring them closer to their ultimate goal, an Islamic state that they can rule without having to worry about the North Americans bombing them all damn day from the sky. Get to work on enlarging it. From there, call it the Greater Caliphate. That's their goal. That's their long-term future. But this is the difference between the near enemy and the far enemy in the first place. This is what distinguished bin Laden and Zawahiri's group from, you know, leftover Islamic Jihad and from Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's group, Ansar al-Sharia, that was more focused on attacking the King of Jordan, etc., was that they wanted to attack the Americans first. James Bamford, in fact, explains it perfectly in his book, A Pretext for War. He says that the way they looked at it, America was already at war with them in 2001, only by way of the Israelis, by way of the kingdoms and their internal security forces, by way of the occupation of Saudi and the bombs and the blockade on Iraq. I mean, from their point of view, these are all just states in the Sunni Arab Union, basically, right? They're not looking at it as foreign people. Killing Iraqis from Saudi, that's like killing Louisianans from Iraq to them. I mean, from Texas, that's what I was trying to say, to them. Kind of same thing. So they say, as long as America's at war against us like this, we can't throw off any of our kings. They're supported by the trillions of the world superpower empire. We've got to bring the Americans here. That's why I'm always quoting Michael Scheuer, saying, never mind even bogging down in Afghanistan, which was the plan. Iraq was the hoped for but unexpected gift to bin Laden. And then Libya and Syria, are you kidding me? This is the ultimate dream come true for Osama bin Laden. The only thing he would prefer more is if America did a regime change for the Mujahideen in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia and in UAE and Qatar and Kuwait. But still, getting rid of Gaddafi, hemming in Assad, fighting for the Sunni radical, breaking off eastern Syria and creating this lawless bin Ladenistan in north and western Iraq. This is the dream come true. And remember, Zawahiri put out a statement back in 2007 saying, we don't want the Americans to go. We want them to stay until hundreds of thousands have been killed, until trillions have been spent, until their empire is broken. So do what you can, jihadis, to provoke them into staying, he said. Too late. Well, now they're trying to pull us back in. And no, it's not that the American government is falling for it. If anybody's falling for it, it's the American people. The American government are taking the opportunity. Just like they did back in 2001. You know, that's the thing. That's my common ground with the 9/11 truthers. I really do think that Al-Qaeda did it. Although I think it's quite possible that the Republicans were looking the other way deliberately, although I don't think that's a proven fact yet. But the real point is, they might as well have done it. George Bush might as well have been the pilot on them damn planes. You know, flying the drone technology himself. For all they did to exploit it, pretend that Saddam did it, and in the process, do exactly what the American people's real enemies were trying to get them to do. You know, their getting away with blue bloody murder is the very same thing as falling into the trap. And here they go again. Oh, good for Lockheed, good for Raytheon, good for General Dynamics, good for JP Morgan, Citibank, Chase, Goldman, whatever the hell. And bad for us and bad for the Iraqis. And you know, Barack Obama's right that these guys really are some Khmer Rouge-style nihilist crazy killers. They are. They're madmen. And as has happened before, pretty much everywhere they go, they'll burn themselves out if we would just stay out. But as Bin Laden put it in his reelect George Bush speech in 2004, there's just too much vested interest at stake. You're going to keep doing what I want you to do, he said. And he was right. Here we are 10 years later. Going back to Iraq. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. One thing that is disturbing to me is reading the Mondo Weiss blog. God dang, man. All right, well, mondoweiss.net, that's the great blog of our friend Philip Weiss, and he's got a whole stable of great writers there besides himself, too. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Phil?
Great, Scott. How you doing?
I'm doing real good. I appreciate you joining us today, and I really appreciate all you guys' work over there.
Thank
Again,
you.
Everybody, it's mondoweiss.net.
Thanks.
Bookmark it and look at it. So I guess first things first is, could you please update us, sir, on the state of the war and or ceasefire and talks and this kind of thing, kind of latest update news, and then we'll rewind a bit.
You know, I'm not up on the latest today, except that the ceasefire was continuing to crumble. It had expired a day or so back, and they haven't come up with revised terms yet, the terms to extend it. And so there's been an exchange of, rocket fire missiles, more deaths in the hours, well, certainly last night. Conflict, this one has lasted now, I think, 53 days since July 8th, and it appears to be in its end phase, because both sides would seem to be weary of the fighting. That being said, Hamas is determined to get the siege of Gaza lifted. The blockade lifted. Gazans have paid a terrible price already for this war, this onslaught. 2,000 people killed, neighborhoods leveled. Most of those people are civilians. And so they regard that, I believe, as a price that they've paid in order to alert the world to the atrocities that are taking place in Gaza, and a means of providing urgency to the demand that this blockade of 7 years be lifted.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing of it, is it's such a permanent institution, this blockade. Obviously, the Israelis don't want to undo it at all. That would be like, you know, surrendering in this war or whatever, politically speaking, in the media and all that in Israel, right? So what would Hamas, what kind of, at least, you know, PR win, what kind of face could they give to Netanyahu in exchange for that?
I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I assume that there are some halfway measures that might allow them to Hamas to save face. But, you know, from the Israeli side, in terms of their saving face, one measure that we reported is that Israelis are saying, well, let's turn Gaza into Ramallah. In other words, let's turn it from an open-air prison, Warsaw ghetto, siege into a sort of three-star occupation, one in which people have the rights to make money, where there's some trade, where there's a neoliberal segment of society that derives benefits from the occupation, and where the level of sort of conflict between the occupier and the occupied is far less contentious than it is in Gaza. So if that's an alternative, I don't know that that's an alternative, but it's been mentioned, and maybe, I don't know what, I think that people in Gaza so want to be reconnected to the world. I mean, that is the great pity of Gaza, having been there, is just the sense of isolation, of being cut off from the world that has been produced by this siege. Students do incredibly well, and they can't go to England or the United States or the Emirates to follow a scholarship that they've earned because of this inhumane siege. And people are denied the sort of natural intercourse with other people in the world, the traveling, freedom of movement, these things we take for granted, they can't have. They don't have an airport. That's been erased from the earth. Now their power plant has been destroyed. So, I don't know, I'm just ranting, but it's just such a tragic and oppressive situation.
Yeah. No, it's important that you do, that people are made to understand this, because I think they just have it backwards. They don't know geography, and they got a picture in their head of Palestine besieging Israel, because that's what John Kerry says, and for some reason he's believable on that.
But we're back to our usual conversation, which is an important one, which is, are Americans catching a clue?
Yeah, no, they are. They are. They're catching on. I mean, and your work is part of that.
No, I'm not. I'm not trying to take credit or berate you. I'm curious. Why do you? Where do you see the evidence of that?
Well, I think it's on Twitter is the most part. I mean, I've seen the evidence of it on TV. I mean, the TV is still absolutely horrible about it. They're still horrible. But on a scale of last year to horrible, they're doing great. You know what I mean? Compared to the Mavi Mamara coverage or something like that. It's like that was in the twilight zone, and this is nearing actual reality here in a way. And I think, and I give most of the credit to Twitter, because regular Joes can say, oh, yeah, Tapper, well, what about this? And push right back on the media stars. And, you know, some of them have, you know, there's a little bit of honesty, a chink in their armor there, where you can get them to answer and be somewhat accountable. And it's certainly different than the Rather Jennings Brokaw era that I grew up in. And, you know, so
Scott,
I think that's the biggest thing of it, really.
At the risk of interviewing you here, I'm interested by the fact that Twitter is so important in your view of this. That's where there's actually some interaction, and where these people are forced to come down to the level of the mortals and engage.
And where regular Joes like me get to talk directly to and be exposed directly to what's happening to the people of Gaza in real time. They got smartphones too, and they're going, oh my God, here's a picture of my dead brother. Ah! And then they tweet it, and I go, oh my God. And then I go, hey, Wolf Blitzer, why don't you ask him about this? Well, he's not that easy to push, but there are others where you can, you know, they're exposed to the same thing I'm being exposed to. It's coming in real time, and it's very real, and you know, even if there's 1% of the pictures are out of context or old from Iraq or whatever, it doesn't matter. It's still the truth of who's Goliath and who's David here is couldn't be more obvious. And it's because people are just going around TV at this point, to where the point where even TV has to concede a bit. But anyway,
that's great. Yeah. That's great.
So I want to talk a little bit more about what you were saying about you know, the idea of turning Gaza back into kind of a full-scale occupation like the West Bank, and how just insane that is, that actually is, it sounds like a pretty good deal compared to what they have now, which really just goes to illustrate that main point again, that these people are not free at all. They are captives there, as you said. And I think people's eyebrows must go up. What do you mean the young people there who do good in school aren't allowed to travel to another country on a scholarship to go to college? What do you mean? They're actually not allowed to leave Gaza? I mean, that's basically classified information in America up until right around now. You know what I mean? And so, you know, for people to be made aware of that, it's changing the whole dynamic here.
Yeah. I want to be clear. There are some cases of students getting out. There's no question. Israel has recognized the public relations disaster that this is. And so they've tried to correct that. And in one case, the State Department actually interceded and said, hey, you got to let these people out. This is a human rights violation. And some were let out. But, you know, it doesn't matter if, you know, 90% are getting out. If you have And when I was there, I met students who could not get out. Wonderful young students who, you know, just the best of any society, dignified, thoughtful, soft-spoken,
and
hardworking,
stuck.
Studious.
Stranded because they're the son of a refugee. All right, I'm sorry,
right.
Grandson. We
got
to go. We'll be right back in just a second with more Philip
right.
Weiss in just a moment, y'all. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Phil Weiss from the Mondo Weiss blog. That's mondoweiss.net. Got a bunch of great writers there, too. Go and check them out, mondoweiss.net. And I'm sorry, Phil, I interrupted you, but for the life of me, I can't remember where we were at the time.
We were just talking about the fact that these wonderful young students often can't get out of Gaza you know, pursue their education.
Right, right.
And certainly the education people are getting, I mean, inside Gaza, I mean, right now the lack of water, the lack of food, the lack of power, the lack of electricity. How often are these kids able to get on the internet if they can get on at all? And that's just kind of a staple of education in the United States. So, you know, I've heard some of the Israeli apologists, liberals like Richard Cohen, at the Washington Post say, well, the United States did this in Vietnam. You know,
yeah.
he was against the Vietnam War, as I remember. So now this is like a role model, America in Vietnam? Wow, that was great. Free fire zones? Great, you know?
Let the carpet bombing begin.
Yes.
Unbelievable. Well, not begin. Let it escalate, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
Jeez. Well, yeah. So let me ask you this then. Because I think, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe it's just within the social media and what have you, but it seems like maybe there's the beginnings of a shift, you know, in TV media, as we talked about, and maybe among the American people. But what about in Washington, D.C.? Are you seeing any movement at all? And what about the leaders of all the wide and varied groups that make up the Israel lobby, and even more broadly than that, the Jewish establishment, Phil?
Well, I think that the way to understand the process is that is the last bastion in the castle. And even after Washington is, our elected representatives are the government that sets the policy. That is the last bastion. And even if you get onto the castle grounds, even if you get across the moat, even if you get across the portcullis and into the chambers of the castle, they're going to be in the turrets. And right now, I think that this battle is taking place inside the, you know, the castle, which I would call the American discourse. And they are still saying, hey, we can live here for the next 6 months up there. And, you know, we got enough food to last. You know, they're very complacent, and they think they've got this thing wrapped up. But I think there are signs that even in Washington, this is starting to erode, in that the elite media are starting to reflect a Palestinian narrative more. They're starting to include more Palestinian voices, and they're feeling the heat from people who are talking about human rights in Palestine. So the Israel lobby has lost Europe. It's lost European governments and certainly the grassroots in Europe. And it's losing the grassroots in the United States. It's losing young Democratic Party faithful and people of color. It's losing all these constituencies in the quote-unquote progressive community, and that is beginning to be felt. And so I would point to the fact that Peace Now, which has supported this Gaza slaughter, the liberal Zionist group largely supported this slaughter. The other day, a young writer who supports Peace Now, a member of Peace Now, Ayelet Waldman, tweeted, I fear that people in Israel have no idea of how internationally isolated that country is becoming. And she's right. And the Israel lobby is similarly isolated. They do not understand how isolated they are and the country is. And that awareness is going to dim in on them and drum in on them in the next, I'd say, year or two. And we will finally, this is a prediction, we will finally see Walden Mearsheimer's book, The Israel Lobby, that classic of reporting on this subject, on 60 Minutes. I predict that'll happen within 2 years. I predict that we will see congressmen openly questioning the special relationship. During the last vote to send another $225 million of arms to a nation that had just committed a massacre of, you know, thousands, that congressional vote was, I think, August 7th or 3rd, I'm blurring a little, 2 weeks ago. There were eight congresspeople who didn't go for it, and that included, you know, some wonderful Republicans like Thomas Massey and Walter Jones of North Carolina, and also progressive like Zoe Lofgren and Republican Justin Amash of Michigan, Jim Moran, and I believe from Virginia, and Keith Ellison from Minnesota. You had this group of people who are true independents on this question, and I think that that caucus of eight is going to just get bigger. That's my, but you know, I'm very glass half full.
Yeah. Well, no, I appreciate the optimism too. And you know, one small footnote there is that Amash was reelected a few days later after that too, while being attacked from the sort of classic, or like, I wouldn't even say neocon, but more just Sean Hannity copycat right sort of a figure.
I didn't know that.
Oh, Amash is an anagram for Hamas. Oh, when? And all this stuff. And Amash still completely destroyed him, 70-something percent to nothing. So
wait, did they actually use that anagram thing on him?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it was all about what a pro-terrorist he is. He's Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda's number one friend in the Congress. And then on his victory speech, he said, no, I don't accept your congratulations, and you owe me an apology, and my family, and blah, blah, blah. And Amash, you know, went after him hardcore.
Wow. Was that the victory
speech?
That was the primary?
Yeah, I guess it was a primary, yeah.
Wow. Well, that's great. I have to catch up on that. Thank you for alerting me to that, Scott.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and that goes to show, hey, you can not just cross the lobby, but you can cross them and win. I mean, maybe depending on who you are. But.
And I think that just it also reveals the spinelessness of our president, because there are reports, more and more reports, that he cannot stand Netanyahu. That Netanyahu has lectured him repeatedly. Netanyahu has told him not to second guess him. The United States has now openly questioned. I should have pointed this out. The U.S. government has now openly criticized Israel for one of its massacres during this war, saying that they were appalled and found disgraceful an attack on a U.N. school. Well, that met a rebuke from the Israeli government, and the United States, in turn, is said to be very upset about the way the Israeli government has conducted itself, including dipping into weapon stocks without approval. So I think that the spinelessness of Obama, he doesn't understand the support he could have if he were to take a stand against this.
Absolutely, yeah. And, I mean, that's the thing of it, is all he has to do is just give us a talk from the Oval Office. My fellow Americans, I'm here to tattletale on Israel for you. Listen up. Here's what's really going on here, okay? And then, blam, their goose is cooked.
Right.
It's all it would take. It's just a little bit of honesty.
Right. I mean, if you consider that George H.W. Bush tried to stand up to the lobby, you know, 23 years ago, and, oh, just over settlement, saying, I'm a man of peace, I want to stand up for peace, and he got his head handed to him in the next election. The elites rebelled against him. But I think even those elites are a little soft now, and Obama could really gain support if he put his foot down.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. If a president wants to buck the consensus on any old thing, he's going to have to rally. I mean, other than what the, you know, the state itself wants to do and the rest of the establishment, he's going to have to really rally the American people. And on this one, there's just no argument. I mean, this is one of the most important issues in American policy. And it's, you know, because of its consequences for the American people. For example, 3,000 who died on 9/11.
Yes.
And so, you know, this is something where it's important enough that it's the kind of thing where he absolutely should be taking a stand,
right,
and could, you know, absolutely.
And don't you think, And he had that determination when he entered office that he shared your view that this was central to American security, and right. he's just dropped it.
Yeah. And the thing of it, too, is I think you must be right. I mean, I don't know exactly, but it must be right that he and Netanyahu don't get along personally at all. Because Netanyahu is basically like the Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan. His contempt for Barack Obama must be absolutely limitless. A black guy telling him what to do? Yeah, right. And so Barack Obama's point of view on that must be, you know, not very gentle in return. I would be telling him to... Well, you know what I would be telling him.
Yeah, and, you know, speaking of which, just to be clear, Condi Rice looked at this issue in something of that fashion back when she got fed up with Israel. She said, they're treating Palestinians the way I was treated as a girl in Birmingham. Mm-hmm. And that touched a deep nerve in her, and she stood up for a second, you know? Right. 1 second.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the best way to put it, too. I've been talking with... Alex Kane and Max, and I think it was the conversation with Kane, we decided Jim Crow is a much better comparison than apartheid for Americans.
Absolutely.
No, you and I talked about that too, yeah. That really brings it home.
Although
especially, like you're saying, when you can even invoke Condoleezza Rice's statement on the right. Thanks so much, Phil, for all
Thank
your
you,
work
Scott.
And your time. Appreciate
Great.
It. MondoWeiss.net, y'all. MondoWeiss.net. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys. Chat room, you decide. Hey, guys. Chat room, guys. We need either to talk about Ukraine for 10 minutes or do another segment where we talk about a bunch of other stuff. Let's do the bunch of other stuff. I get to decide. Oakland activists block Israeli ship for third day. Ha ha. See? Things are changing. It is catching on. And Big Bully can only cry victim for so long before everybody says, actually, you know what? We don't believe you because you're lying, liars. And then that's it, you know? Once faith is broken, that's pretty much the end of that. So now you got some people putting their feet where their mouth says they belong. They're going and occupying the port of Cortland at the who of what? The port of Oakland. And they're trying to block Zim Shipping Services from entering the port and unloading the cargo. And I'm not exactly certain how successful they have been or will be up to this point. I just saw Greenwald tweeted this thing. Oh, this is 2 days old, though. I think I had seen something else that had said that it changed. Anyway, that's pretty cool. At least they're trying. That's the thing. Also, I want to say I got to talk about the cops. Well, first I want to say the same thing I said again the other day about I saw that sign that the woman was holding in Ferguson, and her sign said, Black Life Matters. Well, that's a hashtag now on Twitter. That's a big thing. People got to argue that, hey, if you're born black, then... Yeah, so what? You still got a natural right to your own life. What about that? That's an argument people are having? Yes, that's an argument people are having. Here, I'm telling Mondo Weiss, don't forget to accuse Israel of being Jim Crow all the time. Because that's a shameful part of America's past that they try desperately to live down all the time. Racial segregation in the South for 100 years after the end of the Civil War. 100 years. What a stain. And so if you can make the comparison, if you can say, look, even Condoleezza Rice couldn't help but say, look, being a Palestinian right now is like being a black kid in Alabama when I was a kid and it sucked. And that's how you get Americans to go, oh. And yet... What's the past about Jim Crow? I don't know. I guess a lot of it is, right? I don't know. I'm not a black guy, so I can't really say. And I was born in the mid-70s, so I don't really have anything to compare it to other than history that I learned, stories I've been told. But you gotta admit, it's pretty bad. Everybody's shocked to see, you know, what's going on in Ferguson and all these cops and SWAT and military vehicles and whatever running around and major news people saying, man, this is like a war zone. This is like the occupation of Iraq or Afghanistan. That's what Jake Tapper said. This reminds me of being in Bagram, Afghanistan. They can't help but make that comparison. Guess what? There's a lot of people who felt like they're on the receiving end of a military occupation in this country a long time. The soldiers quartered among us. That's what Thomas Jefferson called them in the Declaration of Independence. The swarms of officers sent hither to harass our people and eat out their substance. That's what we have here. And they'll kill you for looking at them funny. You know, like the rumors of the Crips and the Bloods and the worst of the gang wars of the late 80s. Oh my God, if you look at a Crip funny, they'll kill you. No, that's the LAPD. That's the every PD. And there's an article here, in case you missed it, and you should read the whole thing, not just the very worst quotes, because there's some horrible quotes that are very soundbiteable, right? But there's a whole article here for you in the Washington Post. It's called, I'm a Cop. If you don't want to get hurt, don't challenge me. No matter what, do what I say or I will hurt you. I might kill you, he says. If you have a problem with it, then go to court later. But if you think you're going to argue with me one bit, be prepared for what comes next. And I love how he sings out, don't you scream. Of course, he's got to characterize it as a scream. Don't you try to invoke the fact, is what he means, that you pay my salary. Well, that's supposed to be a thing. The cops are supposed to be our servants, our security force that we allow to exist to protect our natural rights. Yeah, even black people's natural rights. Black Lives Matter, you know. So that's why everybody says that. Hey, man, you're supposed to be my servant. I'm the good guy, and you're supposed to be protecting me, and yet you're treating me like I'm the criminal makes me think you're the criminal. Yeah, well, welcome to America. What took you so long, everybody? And here this cop throws that back. Don't you try to invoke that at me. Who is whose overlord here? Because I'm yours. Watch, I'll prove it. Don't even think of aggressively walking toward me. What? Aggressively walking? Right, because he'll kill you. And as what's-his-name over at Reason points out, this guy's got a PhD in criminal justice. This guy is, you know, speaking for the officer corps of the police. Feel free to sue later, he says, where there's no accountability they have. Quote, I couldn't make this up. It's their term, sovereign immunity. Like they're the king of England and you're nothing but their subject. They're the sovereign, and they own your ass, and they're not your security force, and you are not free. And you may not petition the government for a redress of grievances, because they don't feel like letting you, okay? The same as they'll kill you if they feel like killing you, too. And it's hilarious to see all the pushback. Not all cops are murderers. Yes, they are. What are you talking about? Did you see that on TV or something? And if not all cops are murderers, all of them are accessories to murder. All of them. And you know it. All of them are accessories to any crime that any government employee commits that they will never arrest unless if it's like, you know, a complete total, a postal service employee goes crazy killing people at the post office or something like that. But otherwise, a cop will never arrest a government employee for virtually anything that they do, unless for whatever political reasons the district attorney instructs them to go ahead and move forward on an arrest. Otherwise, if one cop straight waxes 10 people, all of his partners will let him go. They won't handcuff him. They won't tackle him. They won't shoot him in the head to protect innocent life. They'll just take his statement. What was it about those 10? Boy, you must have been really afraid. 10 people, am I right? Give us a statement about how in fear of your life you were, they say. So, I don't know. It's the silver lining to this horror going on in Ferguson right now, is people are beginning to see through a little bit of this. Huh, I wonder if maybe, geez, what if all the people of Ferguson, certainly the black people of Ferguson, would just be better off without a county government at all? Maybe they could just live their lives without this pretended security force at all. Is it okay to question that? Can we go that far? Well, what if we just abolished the police and the sheriff's department and then they were free? Then what? Oh, they would all just kill each other before the police could even get to them, huh? I don't believe that. I wonder if anybody really believes that. If you do, it's because you watch too much TV, man. You know? Way too much TV. Anyway, I don't know, man. So you should read this whole thing because there's a lot of great stuff to it. I didn't sit here and take notes. There's a lot of great little insights into the mind of a cop here in the Washington Post. I'm a cop. If you don't want to get hurt, don't challenge me. Right? Isn't that what a rapist says with his knife to a woman's throat? Just take a sec. Right, Bill Clinton? Who raped Juanita Broderick? You know, for about a few seconds, she said. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me scott@scotthorton.org for more information. See you there. All right, welcome back. Nah, seriously, though, I only pick on Bill Clinton because, yeah, he raped Juanita Broderick. As she very credibly explained to Lisa Myers at NBC News back in 1999. And because, you know, he was the chief executive who sent his stormtroopers out killing Americans all the time. Oh, yeah, and also foreigners, too. All right, anyway. Here, I got to talk about Ukraine and Iraq in a short amount of time. You know, I emailed Thomas Mountain and never heard back, so I think his power must have gone out or something. I don't know what the hell. I don't want to hear back from him. But here, let me get this out of the way real quick. Fun headline, haven't read it yet, but they prove it here with an email. U.S. military bans The Intercept. That's Greenwald and Scahill and etc. The Pentagon has put out a memo saying you're not allowed to read The Intercept. There could be classified information there. And especially it says here, all hands, we have received information from our higher headquarters regarding a potential new leaker of classified information. Although no formal validation has occurred, we thought it prudent to warn all employees and subordinate commands. Please do not go to any website entitled The Intercept, for it may very well contain classified material. Yeah. You know you got problems when the military is being instructed to not look at stuff that has already become open source material on the internet due to journalism. Amazing times, these kooks who run our society. Well, who run the government that sits atop our society anyway. All right, Phil Giraldi coming up in just a few minutes to talk more about Israel. In this case, more about their public relations, specifically. But here, tomorrow I mentioned John J. Mearsheimer is going to be on the show, co-author of The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. with Stephen Walt, and he's a professor at the University of Chicago, and he wrote this new thing for Foreign Affairs. We got interrupted earlier by Dear Leader, but I was playing this clip of the editor of Foreign Affairs. His name is Gideon Rose, and Gideon Rose was explaining to Stephen Colbert. They sort of glossed over the exact coup because of the way Colbert phrased it. Well, the rebels are winning now, right? But that's where he got to the meat of his answer, Gideon Rose, and said, yes, we're trying to get away. And Colbert said, why not spike the football and put it in Putin's face? We're stealing this country away from you. And he literally answered, and I think that this is about the quality of the thinking that goes into this kind of thing. And he's a young, stupid kid, but so's the State Department, you know, in a lot of ways, right? And he said, well, we think he's distracted by the Olympics. Distracted by games. And so won't notice or be able to do anything about it. And so while we're running off with the country, we want to try to not be too bad about it and provoke him into doing something to destabilize the situation. And so that just proves right there what a good guy Gideon Rose is to go ahead and publish this article that explains, without mentioning him, what an idiot he is. Because if he's the editor, is he still the editor of Foreign Affairs? He's now published this article by John J. Mearsheimer called Why the Ukraine Crisis is the West's Fault. The Liberal Delusions That Provoked Putin. And it's by John Mearsheimer, realist, centrist, old Council on Foreign Relations type, University of Chicago, warned you not to attack Iraq in 2003. Came out with a book in 2007, I think, saying, hey, it's time for the establishment to have an honest discussion about the role of the Israel lobby in determining American foreign policies here, okay? And the consequences of our support for Israel. And here he is saying, now, it's the West's fault, which is a nice way of saying Barack Obama's fault. America's fault. And yes, the Europeans were in on it, but come on. Who's the empire and who's the satellite now? Why the Ukraine crisis is the West's fault. And I'm going to let him tell the whole damn story here on the show tomorrow. But in a nutshell, you should know it anyway. It's because when the Soviet Union collapsed and the Russian army ceased being the Soviet army and became the Russian army again and pulled back 1,500 miles back behind their Russian borders. Let all of Eastern Europe and all the stands go independent. Unbelievable. You know, if you were Rip Van Winkle, you would think that I was a damn liar saying that that was possible. That's how the Soviet Union ended? They just gave up? And the people of Russia told the Communist Party, no, your monopoly's over, you're done. And then that was it? And their army came home and they let all of Eastern Europe and all the Asian stands go? No. Well, yes. That's what happened. Soviet Union ceased to exist. Their Warsaw Pact, so-called alliance, which was really domination by Moscow, ceased to exist. And yet, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, the Western, I would say answer, but they started it, the Western counterpart to the Warsaw Pact did not disintegrate. And despite their promises, James Baker and Brent Scowcroft's promises, that's George W. Bush, George H.W. Bush, Bush 41's Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, they promised Mikhail Gorbachev that they would, we're going to reunify Germany. He said, go ahead, reunify Germany. And yes, we're going to bring them into NATO. But we're not going to expand east of Germany, we promise. That was part of the deal. And then the Americans broke it. Bill Clinton broke the deal and started bringing in all of the Eastern European states. And, well, you know, in a nutshell, in case you missed the show tomorrow, Mearsheimer's saying you just pushed too far with this whole last coup in Ukraine. You did too much. You tried to sneak off with it while Putin was distracted with the Olympics, but it didn't work out that way. And now there's a horrible war and at least 1,000 killed, I think more like 2, in eastern Ukraine. Gun battles continue to rage in these two breakaway provinces, really, Donetsk and Luhansk. I'm sorry, I don't say them right. I should ask my wife to help me pronounce all these things and memorize how to say them correctly, since, you know, she's from there. But anyway, they're still fighting. The United Nations says more than 100,000, and this is from June, right? This is 2 months old, that 100,000, 110,000 refugees from eastern Ukraine had fled into Russia. It's probably a big part of the strategy there. And then I had missed this article, but I hope you look at it. It's by Robert Perry at Consortium News from August the 10th, 10 days ago, August 10th, 2014. New York Times discovers Ukraine's neo-Nazis at war. Oh, they did? I missed it. I quit reading the Times. I just can't stand it. But consortiumnews.com for that. Phil Giraldi next. Damn, I had a rack stuff to say. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about commodity discs from commoditydiscs.com. They're 1 ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the backside. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code commodity disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's commoditydiscs.com. Hey, I'm Scott. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm on Liberty Radio Network and scotthorton.org. And man, I'm so bad at fundraising. I was supposed to be mentioning today on the show, I'm still doing this fund drive, and if you could and would, go over to scotthorton.org/donate and donate. But okay, I'll stop beating you over the head with that. Now, I was described to you, I thought maybe I had the link here. I guess it's gone. At the start of the show today, I was saying, yeah, Phil Giraldi's going to be on the show, and he's going to be talking about his piece at uns.com, Fascism in America. And then right as I was wrapping up that segment with that subject, I looked on my Twitter feed, and there was a tweet, and of course Israel is a big part of the article as well, speaking of fascism. And then right there in my Twitter feed was a tweet from the Washington Free Beacon with a big American flag, and it said, Americans just want the good old days back again. Straight out of the article. It couldn't have fit better if Phil Giraldi and his CIA buddies had arranged it that way. Welcome back to the show, Phil. How are you doing?
I'm okay, Scott. How about you?
I'm doing good. Appreciate you joining us today. And yeah, he is former CIA and DIA officer, writes for the American Conservative, uns.com, and Al Jazeera America, sometimes at least, right? Still? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm here every once in a while, yeah.
Okay, yeah. And then he's the executive director of the Council for the National Interest, which I guess you could say is the antidote, the opposite of the Israel lobby in Washington, D.C., councilforthenationalinterest.org. Okay, so, yeah, fascism. You know what? Everybody calls everybody fascist all the time, left, right, and everything else. Fascist just means you disagree with me, I think, something like that, maybe. So why don't we start with a real definition here, Phil?
Well, you know, there are a lot of definitions of fascism, and there are a lot of aspects to it. And in fact, if you look at the history of fascism, you can see that there were a lot of different explanations by the fascists themselves what they represented. And what I latched onto for this piece was essentially the ultra-nationalist sense of fascism, in a way, the racist sense, the sense that the fascist people, the fascist nations, were a superior people and had a right to dictate to others. And if that meant going to war, then that was up to the fascists to decide, and they would punish the people that opposed them, and so on. So it's kind of the sense of ultra nationalism. I hate to say American exceptionalism, which we've been seeing surfacing for the last few years, that I am basically defining as fascism.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, emotional drum beating in place of thought and planning for what's to be done.
Yeah, and in the sense that, you know, we are basically exceptional in the sense that the rules don't apply to us. That essentially was a fascist kind of principle, that if Mussolini wanted to invade Abyssinia, he would go ahead and do it. If Hitler wanted the Lebensraum in Eastern Europe, he would attack Poland. You know, there's this racial sense, there's this nationalist sense. It's all combined in the same agenda. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, maybe I have it wrong about the cart coming before the horse and all that, but I had always thought that American exceptionalism at its base, what it really meant was we're exceptional because we really do have a consensus for freedom here and we mean to keep it. And so the whole world wants to be like us because our system, at least we strive to always make it as best as we possibly can and set an example for the rest of mankind that life doesn't have to be so nasty, brutish, and short if only you're free like us. But I don't know how the hell that got twisted into, which means that we're so good that rules don't apply to us and moral laws don't apply to us and we all have a license to kill you, that kind of thing. That would seem like the complete opposite, even with the same name, you know?
Yeah, well, with the last crop of Republicans running for president, you probably recall, they were quizzing each other on, do you believe in American exceptionalism? And here we have people like Sarah Palin coming out with this kind of thing. She doesn't have a clue what she's saying. And what she means is that the United States basically could set its own rules. And you're quite right. You know, we are an exceptional country. We are historically an exceptional country. But so is every other country. Every other country has its own history and its own beliefs and things like that. Right. We shouldn't feel that we necessarily are forcing our values on others.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, I mean, we've all tangled in comment sections here or there or, you know, looked on in horror at them too, but you got a very particular story in this article about a friend of yours who wrote an article and the comment section that followed and the kind of consensus of the rabble about what she had written, and it seems pretty informative there. Can you give us a rundown of that part of it?
Yeah, this is a friend of mine. I've known her for quite a few years. She's a retired Army lieutenant colonel. She was an Army lawyer involved with Guantanamo Bay prisoners. Both defense and in terms of resolving some of the issues involved with Guantanamo. And so she's very highly qualified. She's a very strong Christian, evangelical Christian, in fact. And she basically wrote a letter to the paper saying, you know, we've essentially lost our moral roots here in that we're seeing this slaughter of 2,000 Palestinian, mostly civilians, going on. And our government is aiding and abetting it, and nobody seems concerned. So it was kind of a letter, okay, not everybody's going to agree with it. But what was really shocking was the degree to which people wrote in not only criticizing what she said or what her viewpoint was, but criticizing her as a person in the most humiliating terms, and also basically saying things like, you know, I really don't care if one of the comments was something effective, if 4.5 million Palestinians are killed in self-defense, I really don't care, that's just fine with me, that kind of thing. So I basically pulled all these comments together, and I put them together to show just how we indeed have lost our moral footing in the world, if this is what people believe.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, it just goes to show, you know, people believe whatever they hear repeated in their echo chamber and all that confirmation bias and basic, you know, social psychology 101 sort of stuff. Hey, we all think kill all the Arabs, right, everybody? And if nobody is saying absolutely not, what are you, crazy? Then, yeah, I guess that's what we all think. In fact, I've seen, you know, rabid warmongers find out that a family member that they really respect thinks the exact opposite and then just on a dime, blam, drop every stupid thing that they were wrong about and instead defer to their respected authority who is different,
yeah,
even though they're as rabid as could be a minute before. So it's just people just go by, you know, the group they want to fit into, I guess, more than anything else here, seems like.
Yeah. Well, the unfortunate thing is, you know, some of the people who made comments were people who should know better. They were clearly military veterans and indeed military officers in some cases. And there were also some people who clearly were believing Christians. These people actually should have a better sense of that you don't advocate genocide. And just kind of do it off the cuff and say this is something that's perfectly acceptable. And yet that's what they were advocating.
Yep. Well, and, you know, it seems like what's going on in Ferguson could be something that is something we all see a lot more often in every state, assuming we have worse economic problems or another few major terrorist attacks or something like that. Things get really bad here, and it's really sad to see that whatever, you know, giant plurality or giant proportion of the population is ready to fall in line behind a military form of government, as Tommy Franks put it, and stay there. They would prefer it that way.
Yeah, there's a feeling that you're safer that way. Of course, you're not, because you're subject to the whims of the military authorities. And to me, you're right. I mean, you're saying the right thing about Ferguson. In my county here in Virginia, we've had two people killed by the police in the last year in situations where that kind of force was not did not have to be used. And yet, you know, nothing has happened. In fact, one of the cases is still, quote, under investigation.
Yeah. All right. I'm sorry. We got to stop right there, but that's a good stopping place. We'll be right back with Phil Giraldi, y'all. Unz.com, UNZ.com. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. You know what? For those of you who asked for the list of bumper music, I think I forgot this one. It's Dresden 45, Swiss Bank Account. I love this song. It's great. All right. Anyway, I'm talking with Phil Giraldi. And sorry about that, Phil. Got interrupted by the commercial break like we always do there. But we were talking about fascism, American support for it. You were saying in your local county there are at least two questionable shootings already this year. Is that right?
In the past year, there have been two killings of people that where lethal force was in no way required, and yet nothing has happened. There's here in Virginia, when there's a killing by local police, it's investigated by the state police. So you have the police investigating the other police when there's a killing. So you know nothing is going to happen. And anyway, what I'm saying about Ferguson, the scary thing is we still don't know really what happened there. I mean, we really don't. But the fact is that what is frightening is a display of militarized police, and the fact that our police first response is a military response. And that's what everybody should be talking about and everybody should be thinking about. I'm sure on your show you are. But there's not enough of that in the media, because that really is the issue.
Right. Yeah, I mean, pretty much the poor black people in any ghetto in America already feel like they're occupied, even when the cops are wearing shirts and slacks and carrying pistols and have felt like that. But when you're talking literally about these guys being armed up more than the U.S. infantry in battle in Iraq and acting out the part against them, it's just completely out of control. And at least, you know, it seems like this thing with Ferguson, maybe they push it too far, and they're getting a reaction even from the center here. That, like, hey, wait a minute, how far down this road have we really gone? What is this, David Addington's dream or what?
Yeah, more like a nightmare, I think. I mean, it's just the images were just were frightening. You know, this is not police crowd control. This is way, way beyond that. This is a military response to what is a civil procedure, which is policing. Yeah. And it's just unbelievable to watch it.
But, you know, Phil, if we just use enough force, we could have the good old days back again.
That's right. We could take over the Sudetenland, too.
Yeah. All right. Well, and so now here's the great segue between your two articles. The other one, this one is Fascism in America at UNS Review, and then the other is over at the American Conservative Magazine, Israel's Information Ops. And, of course, what they have in common is Israel. and you talk quite a bit about sort of the very same right-wing nationalism at play in Israeli society and in Israeli government policy as here, and then also the propaganda, which of course is part and parcel of fascist regimes too, is they got to lie all damn day to make any of this seem reasonable. So,
yeah, that's basically what the article talks about. How, in terms of the recent killings in Gaza, obviously Israel has felt very, very wrong, on the wrong side of the propaganda war, or on the public affairs war, and so they've unleashed their secret army, which is the people that appear on all the websites that we go to and make repeated comments in favor of Israel and what Israel is doing, and they do this clandestinely. They don't use their real names. If they're Israelis, they don't say that they're Israelis. This is a government program which organizes people to confuse other people and feed them propaganda on the internet. And it goes far beyond anything that I know that is being done by any other government. And of course, Israel is at the same time a recipient of large amounts of U.S. money. So this is a factor in terms of, you know, what kind of policies they're trying to influence. So it's the U.S. taxpayer gets like a double whammy.
Yeah. Well, and the thing of it, too, is, as you put it in the article, it's usually pretty obvious who's the sock puppet, but still, it's quite disruptive when people are trying to have a constructive conversation, and you got people chiming in with their nonsense all the time.
Yeah, it's always the same kind of boilerplate. They actually get instructions from the foreign ministry in Tel Aviv telling them what the issues are that they should be addressing. There is a software that comes out of Israel. It's called Megaphone, and the people who are on this Megaphone system, there are allegedly 50,000 of them, each get instructions in terms of what articles to focus on to attack, what lines to use in making the attack, and so on and so forth. So it's a highly coordinated effort, and it's government-run.
Yep. And now, there's this new article, too, at Common Dreams today, the double identity of an anti-Semitic commenter. And I don't know, I actually didn't get to the end of this article because I ran out of time here doing the show today, Phil. But so I don't know if they trace this back to the Israeli government at all. But certainly they have busted, or I don't know, certainly they claim to have busted a Jewish Harvard graduate student, or no, just graduate, for being a sock puppet, but not coming online everywhere and accusing everyone of being an anti-Semite and spitting out talking points about Israeli self-defense for their aggression, but instead pretending to be an anti-Semite and going completely crazy and trying to smear everybody's honest dissent, or, you know, to catch up everybody's honest dissent with his quite dishonest dissent there.
Yeah, that's exactly it. This is kind of a reverse tactic where he was basically pretending to be an anti-Semite and making outrageous comments frequently. He did over 1,000, I think the article said, he did over 1,000 comments in 2 years. And they were all basically attacking this website because he didn't approve of the website being critical of Israel. So he made it look like 1,400 times. Apparently, and he made it look like it was a haven for anti-Semites, which of course it wasn't. And as a result, the organizers of the site and everything apparently suffered serious damage in terms of their reputation.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and then they claim they bust him by way of his IP address and all that. Did their investigation and found him out. But
because, you know, people don't use their true names on comments and stuff like that very often, just because there's no reason why you should have to. But
sure,
where you have people that are changing their identities frequently so as not to be seen as the same person, then that's something else. That's I don't know if it's categorized as criminal behavior, but it's certainly being extremely deceptive.
Yeah,
and that's what this guy was doing. He kept changing his name, and they finally figured out, yeah, he's changing his name, but it's all coming from the same computer.
Right. Well, and yeah, you know, guilt by association is bad enough when somebody's just pointing their finger at somebody, but when you got to make up who it is they're supposedly associated with in order to smear them, that's pretty damn bad. And, you know, that brings up the question, that these guys haven't seemed to ask themselves, and maybe I shouldn't ask it and just let them go on, but it seems all very counterproductive to me. That, like, wow, hey, you know, just on the kind of basic level for those who are new at this, hey, maybe the Israelis, maybe the reason they're lying all the time is because what they're doing is wrong. I wonder if maybe that's what's going on here. It just makes it more transparent when their lies are so blatant, and they'd be better off just doing whatever bombing campaign against whatever, you know, babies they want to bomb, but just shut up about it instead of insulting my intelligence all day long at the same time and extra pissing me off.
Well, but the funny thing is, of course, if you link the two articles, the good people down there in Augusta, Georgia, obviously have bought into a lot of this stuff. They a lot of their comments repeated the same kind of boilerplate that the Hasbara, the Israeli government employees, were using to justify what Israel was doing in Gaza, saying that Israel was defending itself, that Israel did not initiate this war, that that Hamas did. You know, it was the same arguments, and these people down in Georgia seem to have bought into it hook, line, and sinker.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, it's just me. This stuff works. That's why they do it. It works.
Sure, it works.
Yep. And yeah. Well, and I want to emphasize how great this article is, because you really did do the work here and go back and show the different organizations and link to original sources and other secondary source journalism about it and that kind of thing. So for people who really want to know a lot about how it is that Israel runs these sock puppets on the internet to try to bog you down in your activism, it's Israel's Information Ops at theamericanconservative.com. And you can find out all about it there. And, well, we're about out of time anyway. So thanks again, Phil, for your time on the show.
Appreciate okay, Scott. Always a pleasure.
All right, you. So that's Phil Giraldi, former CIA and DIA officer, executive director of the Council for the National Interest, and writer for The American Conservative magazine at theamericanconservative.com, The UNS Review at UNS.com, UNZ, UNS.com, and for America.aljazeera.com. See you tomorrow.